What games did you actually organize? I guess it wasn't fish.
No, it wasn't fish. It was the Texas Hold'em poker.
Molly, did you even know how to play poker?
No. And, yeah. And by the way, I still really don't.
Really? Hi, I'm Kathy Bernard.
I'm Barbara Klein.
Thanks so much for tuning in.
The first woman to row three oceans, her bone-chilling adventures. What made her do it?
Then, ordinary people with extraordinary resting places. You'll want to take a tour.
Plus, wading through life insurance lingo, understanding the options, and finding out who really needs it.
Next, the poker princess and her high-stakes Hollywood poker games.
And we'll shoot the breeze and talk online dating advice with one boomer dude.
Roz Savage was a latecomer to the world of adventure. Her routine consisted of toiling away at a desk job into her 30s. Now, she's made up for lost time exponentially. She holds four world records for ocean rowing, and she's the first woman to row three oceans, the Atlantic, Pacific, and Indian. In 2010, National Geographic named Roz Savage Adventure of the Year.
She's written several books about her life-altering adventures, including Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean. While it's nonfiction, it reads like a thriller. Roz joins us on the phone from London. Happy to talk with you, Roz.
It's a real pleasure to be with you.
How on earth did you come up with this brilliant idea to row the ocean? I mean, did you have a particular fondness for rowing?
I had rowed before. I rowed when I was at university, but then I hadn't rowed for about 10 years. I sort of had an early midlife crisis of some sort when I really decided that spending the rest of my life toiling away in an office cubicle was not what I wanted to do, sort of combined with an environmental epiphany. And so to me, it seemed kind of logical in a strange way to decide to take on this massive personal challenge to row solo across these oceans and to use that as my platform to raise environmental awareness.
Well, Roz, how did you prepare physically for this adventure? I mean, were you physically fit when you first started this thing?
I was in pretty good shape, yeah. Even after I gave up rowing, I'd stayed fit by going to the gym and I'd run a couple of marathons. I do have to tell you, though, I'm not an actual athlete. I know that might sound weird given that I've spent 520 days of my life rowing across oceans, but I really have to force myself to do physical exercise. I do not enjoy it. I'd much rather be sitting on the sofa eating chocolate chip cookies. For that first voyage, I wanted to train so that my body wouldn't have any surprises when I set out. So I was doing like up to 16 hours a day on the rowing machine, which was so boring, I can't tell you. But actually, the strategy didn't work at all because within the first 2 weeks, I had tendonitis in my shoulders, which gave me all sorts of trouble the whole way across the Atlantic. So after that, I resorted to what's known in ocean rowing circles as weight training, but it's not W-E-I-G-H-T, it's W-A-I-T. You wait until you get in the boat and then you start training.
Oh, gosh.
And actually, that worked much better. You just kind of take it easy for the first few days and ease into it because it's not flat out Olympic type rowing. Obviously, you can't do the same kind of level of exertion for up to 5 months, which is what it took me to cross the Indian Ocean, as you would do over 2,000 metres in 6 minutes. So it's more like the kind of level of activity of going for, you know, a long hike for the day, carrying a light day pack. So your heart rate's up a bit, but you're not in the aerobic zone. You're not going flat out.
Well, Roz is the only solo woman rower on the Atlantic Adventure. How were you treated by the male participants?
I do get asked if I've encountered any prejudice because of being a woman, but I suppose never having been a man, I can't really compare how the two experiences were. I think maybe I did have a bit of a credibility problem for the Atlantic. When I was trying to get sponsorship, I almost completely failed. I managed to raise about 1/7 of what it cost me to do the Atlantic. And I suspect that a lot of people looked at me, and I was by then 37 years old. I'm 5'4" on a good day. And I just don't really look like a transoceanic rower. So I don't think there was really any prejudice from the other rowers, but maybe from potential sponsors, it was more of an issue.
Well, Roz, it was so fascinating to read about your boat and what you could pack in that little thing. Can you describe it for our listeners? What did it have in it?
Sure. The boat is specially built for ocean rowing. So, crucially, it's got a relatively watertight sleeping cabin, which makes life a lot more pleasant. It's 23 feet long and 6 feet wide, with the sleeping cabin at the stern and a smaller storage cabin in the bow. And then in between the cabins, there's the sort of open cockpit area, which is where all the rowing happens. And there's plenty of storage space, particularly below decks, below the waterline. It's designed to be self-sufficient for however long it takes to row across an ocean. So there's plenty of room to take all your freeze-dried food with you. There's a water maker that sucks in seawater and turns it into fresh water. It's also designed to be self-righting, because chances are that at some point, some big wave's going to come and get you and the boat's going to capsize.
That sounds like an important feature of the boat.
It is very important. It is crucial that you keep the cabin hatches closed, because those are the buoyancy chambers. They trap air so that the boat's unstable in the upside down position, which means that slowly, a bit too slowly for my liking, it will gradually roll the right way up again after a capsize. So it is designed to handle that, but I have to say that capsizes are not fun.
Let's get down to brass tacks here. I mean, was there a toilet and a shower, perhaps?
Well, of sorts. I mean, it was pretty basic. It's known as bucket and chuck it.
Ooh, we get the picture. Kind of do it yourself, huh?
Exactly, yeah. There just isn't the kind of space or the water supply to have a more conventional facility, so yes, it's pretty basic. But a secret between girls, the female urinal changed my life. Saves an awful lot of palaver and mess. So I'll leave people to Google that or just imagine it.
Oh, okie dokie. And Roz, what safety systems were in place? I mean, should you get into major trouble in the open water? And what communication devices did you have, or navigation equipment?
For navigation, I had GPS, or in fact about five GPSs, because ocean, air and seawater are pretty brutal on electronics. For communication, I had a satellite phone, which is my main means of communication with dry land. It actually broke 24 days before the end of the Atlantic, which you would think would be a complete nightmare, but actually I felt like it was quite a privilege to kind of be able to travel the old-fashioned way, you know, when people used to just set off and didn't have email and didn't have satellite phones, and you know, you would just know they were safe when you got a letter from them when they reached the other side. I also had VHF radio, but that only works on line of sight, so you have to be able to see another vessel. Luckily, about 12 days after my satellite phone broke, I did see a passing vessel, so I was able to get a message back to my poor, long-suffering mother to let her know that I was okay. Mm. And apart from that, I also had, it's not exactly a communications device, but there's a transponder which beams back the position of my boat sort of every hour or so via satellite to a central computer, so that people could follow my voyages online in kind of real time, see where I was on the map.
Our guest is Roz Savage, adventurer and author of several books, including Rowing the Atlantic, Lessons Learned on the Open Ocean. You're listening to the Two Boomer Babes. I'm Barbara Klein, and my co-host is Kathy Bernard. You can listen to the show anytime on the iHeartRadio app or at twoboomerbabes.com. Now back to our conversation with Roz Savage. So, Roz, I'm curious, what was your rowing schedule like? How many hours a day were you actually rowing the boat?
I was rowing between 10 and 12 hours a day, depending on how enthusiastic I was feeling. Like I say, it was low intensity, but boredom was quite an issue. I have a sort of butterfly mind and very quickly get fed up with things. On the Atlantic, I had my stereo broke really early on. So that was really quite brutal for me, just kind of being alone with my thoughts for the best part of 3.5 months.
So how did you deal with that boredom? I mean, did you talk to yourself or did you sing songs?
I would be so bored with myself.
I didn't think singing songs, if you heard my singing voice, I don't think that would have cheered me up very much. Although I did sometimes. Spent a lot of time swearing at the ocean. Learned why sailors have a reputation for bad language. I did talk to myself. I did a lot of counting of oar strokes. And I would do things like try and picture a house where I'd lived, and I moved around quite a bit. And I would try and remember every last detail of that house, or else I'd focus on a particular friend of mine and try and remember every detail of how they look and their voice and think of all the experiences that we'd been through together, really just trying to find a kind of rich seam of a memory that would keep my mind entertained for a while. But I have to confess, after The Atlantic, I sort of felt like I cheated. I started listening to audiobooks and I became completely addicted. And in fact, just a couple of weeks ago, I was recording the audiobook of Rowing the Atlantic. And I quite like to think that maybe some future ocean rower might be rowing across an ocean listening to me reading a book about rowing across an ocean.
Roz, you mentioned tendonitis in your shoulder, but did you sustain any other injuries from that constant, nonstop rowing?
Again, a slightly indelicate subject, but all ocean rowers tend to have a problem with saltwater sores on the bottom, because really you're sitting on this same seat for 12 hours a day, and the salt water gets into the fabric and chafes, and so you get these kind of like spots. It might sound like a trivial thing, but actually it can be incredibly painful. It did take me a while to figure out a good strategy, which was to have a constant rotation of seat covers made out of pack towel, which is that kind of very absorbent fabric that they make towels out of to take camping with you. And so it's very fast drying as well. So just at the end of every rowing shift, I would take the old one off, rinse it out, hang it up to dry and put a fresh one on. And that did help somewhat.
Well, Roz, did you have any close calls? I mean, it's almost like brushes with death where you thought, this is it, I'm going to die on the Atlantic.
Well, the first couple of weeks were absolutely terrifying. I was so far outside my comfort zone, it just was untrue. And it took a while for me to really develop the trust in my boat. From inside the cabin, the waves just sounded enormous. And I was convinced the boat was going to break apart. But then after a couple of weeks and the boat hadn't broken apart, I started to think, well, hopefully it'll carry on not breaking apart. But I think apart from the very psychological fear that comes from if you're in a storm and you're always semi-expecting a capsize, probably the closest that I came to actually dying was entirely my own stupid fault. It was on the final stage of the Pacific voyage. I was just coming into Papua New Guinea, having rowed from San Francisco, and I accidentally dropped my boat hook overboard. And I didn't need it because I had another one stowed away, but I'd done so much campaigning against pollution in the oceans, especially sort of plastic pollution. I thought, well, I can't leave it there. I've got to go back and get it. So I sort of peeled off my iPod and my sun hat and my rowing gloves and jumped into the water and swam back to get it. And then when I picked it up and looked to see where the boat was, I realized that as I've been swimming that way, the boat's been drifting that away. Mm. And it looked quite a scarily long distance away. It was such a struggle for me to catch up with that boat. It seemed to take absolutely forever. And it might sound a bit kind of corny, but really what gave me the motivation to find that extra burst of speed that I needed was me recalling a promise I made to my mother that I would not get separated from my boat. So as I'm there in the water, getting separated from my boat, I just thought, I can't let this happen. My mum will kill me.
That's good motivation, Roz.
Well, indeed, it was. You can't let your mum down like that, can you?
No, no way. Well, Roz, how much sleep were you able to get on the voyage? What would you do? Just throw the anchor over in, 3,000 feet of water? I mean, what do you do?
You can put out a sea anchor, which is like a kind of parachute on a rope that you put out underneath the water so it grabs hold of a ton of seawater. But actually, you can make some good miles overnight if the wind and the currents are in your favor. So generally, I would just kind of stow everything away for the night, go into my cabin and put my head down and keep my fingers crossed that, first of all, I wouldn't get run over by a container ship, and secondly, that I might end up a few miles to the good come the morning. And I suppose the amount of sleep that I got really varied depending on the conditions. I'm quite a light sleeper, and I think when you're on the ocean anyway, you always want to have half an ear out for any sort of unusual sounds. So sleep was a sort of patchy affair, but I think the main relief was just to be not rowing and to have my weight off my backside. So, you know, it was nice, even if I was just lying there and not particularly sleeping, at least you do get some rest.
Well, Roz, finally, 24 days before the end of the trip crossing the Atlantic, your satellite phone no longer worked. I'm so curious because I can't imagine, I don't think most people can, what it's like to be all alone in the middle of the Atlantic with no way to communicate. Can you briefly describe for us what that's like?
Actually, it felt like a real privilege. I think in our crazy modern world, it's so difficult to find a time and a place where you can just be really alone with yourself and not to have any external input at all. You know, we spend from dawn till dusk, we're bombarded with input from billboards and advertisements and just words everywhere. And so to kind of just be for a while, just to be out in nature alone, to feel very much part of that natural world, looking up at the stars at night or appreciating the sunrises and the sunsets, I felt like it was not necessarily a privilege I would have chosen, but seeing as it happened anyway, I found that I became much more centered, much more grounded, so to speak, in the middle of the ocean. And it was a really empowering and life-enhancing experience.
Roz Savage, who holds 4 world records for ocean rowing, by the way, thanks so much for sharing your inspiring story with the 2 Boomer Babes.
It's been such a pleasure. Thank you.
And give our very best to your mother.
I will do. I think she's earned it. She's got a few more gray hairs than she did when I started out on this.
I'm sure she does. What these children put their mothers through.
The Babe's favorite cemetery tour guide is back, just in time for Halloween. Renowned photographer and writer Doug Keister is dubbed Chief Tombstone Tourist. He is the author of several guidebooks about cemeteries, including Going Out in Style.
Doug's guidebooks give GPS directions to the graves of celebrities, mafia bosses, voodoo queens, fried chicken moguls, and ordinary people with extraordinary resting places. All of this makes his books about the dead, well, so lively. Welcome back to 2 Boomer Babes, Doug. Always great to have you.
Always good to be back with the babes.
So what is it about poking around in cemeteries that you find so fascinating?
Well, I've always been a real kind of mystery lover and a sleuth, and it's just discovering architecture and interesting tombstones, and cemeteries are a real pure environment. You know, what's there is supposed to be there, and it's very enjoyable. It's a great place to go for a walk. Cemeteries preceded public parks as open space in America.
And I like how you put it that it's like going to a museum.
And it's a free museum. Which definitely is a point in its favor.
Well, I bet they're glad to have company. I mean, think about it.
Well, who's going to charge? Who's going to be the ticket taker?
Yeah.
Yeah. Really. Now, Doug, we hear that there was actually a golden age of cemeteries during Queen Victoria's Day, which came to an end, so to speak, during the Depression.
Right.
But you say that the cemetery is making a comeback thanks to boomers of all people. So why is that?
Cemeteries were very standoffish for a long time because they didn't see any benefit of live people in the cemetery. But when the boomers started passing on to the next adventure, you might say, and they wanted to do something different rather than just kind of a meat and potatoes type of tombstone, they started doing really interesting tombstones. And so that just kind of promoted visitation and kind of also just that general interest in historic things. And I don't know if boomers have it more than other people. Certainly young people don't seem to have it much nowadays, but the boomers kind of leading the wagon train, you might say, into the cemetery, and other people are following. Very, very interesting phenomenon.
You know, Doug, I have to tell you, you talk about being fascinated with cemeteries, which I don't think I really am, but there is a cemetery in my little hometown that has been resurrected, so to speak. Been, you know, kind of rehabilitated. Well, guess what? There's a marker for a little guy named Samuel Barreau, who was the little drummer boy during the Revolutionary War. What about that factoid for you?
Well, matter of fact, in Greenwood Cemetery in New York, they have the same thing. There's the first casualty from New York was a drummer boy who was actually hit by friendly fire. But it's a very, very popular monument. And things like that are all getting redone or rehabilitated, like you say, resurrected is even it's a great word for the cemetery. So that it's just really, really increasing what's called cemetery tourism.
Doug, let's talk about some of these very unusual and extraordinary tombstones and tombs that are found in these cemeteries. Okay, so taste, as we all know, is very subjective, and that extends, of course, to final resting places. Can you tell us about a tomb? We always love the most, you know, garish ones that was just beyond the pale of good taste. I mean, even for the boomer babes.
Well, that's a stretch.
Really?
Yeah, really.
Well, there's one in Cimitero Monumentale, you have to sound Italian when you say it, that it's the Pierre Hori, of all things, mausoleum, and even the guidebooks say it is utterly unclassifiable architecturally. I mean, you see this thing, and you just don't know what it is. It's a mausoleum, but it's just got everything you could imagine attached to it, you know, as far as what passes for decoration. The architects love to design mausoleums because it's a triumph of form over function because, you know, they don't have to do much. And so architects love to do this stuff, and they, if they're given a free rein, they will come up with some fantastic designs.
And I guess the person isn't going to complain. I mean,
yeah,
they're
kind
of voiceless at this
c'est
point.
La vie.
Well, and it's also true that, you know, a lot of times architects, you know, the original impression of some of these wild things is kind of negative. But after a while, something like the Eiffel Tower, people hated it. But now, of course, it's a huge thing. It's the same with cemetery things. It's kind of wild and wacky, but after a while, it becomes, you know, the place everybody goes to see. You got to see this thing. You know? Look at this. So.
Well, you say that we only have one chance to really kind of make that lasting impression, which I guess is what you're referring to.
Right.
But tell us about a person that really hit the mark.
I think, you know, epitaphs are always some of the most fascinating things on tombstones. Obviously, most of them are just, you know, born and died and it's a little, you know, religious verse or something like that. But I think my favorite all the epitaphs would be Mel Blanc, you know, the voice of Looney Tunes, who just said, "That's all, folks."
I love that.
And there's also, though, I probably one I can't repeat about a cowboy and something about his saddle, but
I think we figured that one out.
Yeah, you figured that one out.
This is a family-friendly show.
Yeah. And there's also a one where a mistress and an ex-wife got together and put this something on somebody's tombstone with a little bit of a puzzle. You have to kind of read it a lot to figure it out, and it's not too kind.
So they kind of stick it to them at the end, huh?
Yeah, yeah. It's a good good reason to, you know, get your tombstone ahead of time. Don't leave it up to somebody else.
Okay, well, Doug, you've obviously seen a lot of cemeteries in your day. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, you know, I get that all the time, and I've got like 10 favorites, and I won't even list them all, but, you know, the most cemetery-like cemetery, you know, what your vision of a cemetery has got to be Sleepy Hollow.
And I why mean, is that?
Well, it's got the Headless Horseman to start. That gives it a really big boost in the beginning. But it also has the rolling hills. It's got a great mix of really old tombstones and some new stuff, and it's got some dirt roads, and it just has the feel of a cemetery. But there are so many others. I mean, Greenwood Cemetery in New York is, you know, the first kind of large cemetery in the New York area. Hollywood Forever, where they show movies in the cemetery. Like I said, Cimitero Monumentale in Milan, where it's like an outdoor sculpture gallery. And, you know, Houdini's grave, you know, in Machpelah Cemetery.
And where is that?
That's in Brooklyn. It's in New York, and it's kind of one of the scary type cemeteries because it's kind of run down. But Houdini's grave is there, and it's very hard to get into. But if you can worm your way into it, and you see,
you have
Houdini's
to be a Houdini.
Grave. Yeah,
yeah.
You do to get in and out. So there's some great cemeteries. And, you know, the problem, you know, a lot of times people ask me what the scariest cemetery is, and, you know, with all this tombstone tourism going on, you know, there's not a lot of them anymore because there's so many people wandering around. I have been scared one time in a cemetery. I was searching for Superman in a mausoleum and walking down this corridor, and there wasn't anybody in the mausoleum. And all of a sudden, right to my left, there was somebody standing about 2 inches from me.
Ooh!
It scared
the daylights.
You know who it was? It was me. There was a full-length mirror.
Ooh!
Oh, and it just—it was the scariest I've ever felt in a cemetery.
Really?
Yeah, that was. I'm doing a tour in November, in a nighttime tour in that cemetery. It's in Los Angeles. And so that's going to be fun.
Well, real quickly, it's almost Halloween. And if you were to pick the creepiest place to visit, besides that Superman little quest you went after, where would it be? Which cemetery?
I would probably say Magnolia Cemetery in Charleston, because it's kind of a swampy, and it's got all the Spanish moss that's hanging down. And it's not... It's kind of off the beaten track, so it's not a real popular cemetery, but it's got all of that ghoulish sort of stuff going on.
And they have the kind of fog it sets in at
night.
Ooh.
Yeah.
I'm getting scared already.
Yeah. And the Spanish moss caps it off.
Oh, it does.
Hanging from the trees and getting in your face, you know, so when you're walking around.
Well, Chief Tombstone Tourist Doug Keister, thanks so much for joining the Two Boomer Babes and getting us both in the Halloween spirit.
Thank you. It's always good to be on the program.
Support comes from Accent on Travel Rehoboth Beach with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the Two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Up next, unraveling the life insurance lingo. Should you be covered? Stay with us.
Life insurance. Ugh. Thinking about it and wading through the variety of options is almost attuned to that twice-a-year visit to the dentist. The confusing and frustrating process of evaluating life insurance has led to 19 million Americans who are shopping around for a policy to stay on the fence. So says the Life Insurance and Market Research Association.
So joining us to sort through all the lingo is Scott Hallowell, a certified financial planner and the host of a financial segment on the VFW radio show, The National Defense. Scott joins us from beautiful San Antonio, Texas. Welcome, Scott.
Hello, how are you?
Great. Well, you know what? The subject of insurance boggles my mind still, and I won't tell you how old I am, but I'm old enough that I should know about insurance. So who actually needs life insurance?
Oh, boy. You know, it comes down to anybody who has someone else who is dependent on them either financially or who would end up in a worse financial spot if that person passed away, and the person who might pass away doesn't have enough resources to help out otherwise. So, you know, typical examples are, you know, you could have a husband and wife. They've built a life together. They've got all of the expenses and all of the, you know, debts and bills associated with a married life. If one of them passes in and are both contributing from an income perspective, one passes away, well, the other one would be in a bad spot otherwise. And so, you know, maybe they need life insurance. You know, people who have children need life insurance. People who, you know, support their adult parents, maybe, you know, as parents get older and you get into the sandwich generation discussion. Some of them, you know, need life insurance. So it's really a case of if someone's depending on you financially, then you really need to look at your situation. If you don't have enough other assets, then life insurance could be a way to fill in that gap.
So when should somebody think about buying it? Is it before they get into that situation or when they get in that situation?
The thing about life insurance is one of the challenges is it requires medical underwriting if you're getting a real life insurance policy. And what that means is you have to go through and answer health questions depending on the amount of coverage that you're receiving. You might actually have to have a small medical exam. I mean, there's health requirements to get the insurance. And so, generally speaking, the younger you are when you apply, the easier it will be to get it and the cheaper it will be to get it because, you know, you're less likely to have something wrong with you from a physical perspective. And quite frankly, as you're younger, you're less of a risk to the insurance company that you might pass away.
Now, Scott, we've read that we can use the acronym LIFE to determine our life insurance needs. How does that work?
It's a really good back-of-the-envelope calculation. What you do is you take the letters LIFE, then L would stand for liabilities, or what debts would you want to have paid off in the event of your death. So if you get a mortgage, car payments, things like that, and you'd want those paid off, that would go into that category. The I stands for income needs of the survivor. So take my personal situation. My wife is a stay-at-home mom. And so, you know, I'm right now bringing all the income into our house. If I were to pass away, my wife and two kids would need money to live on. They would have an income need there. And so I would have to figure out what that is and factor that into my life insurance calculation. The F stands for final expenses or funeral expenses, fairly straightforward. And then the E it stands for education goals, because a lot of people are looking at life insurance, have children. They're trying to figure out how I pay for school if I were to pass away. But it could be any other goal that you might have for which you would need the money if you weren't here. So those four letters, LIFE, add all those things up, and that will give you an idea of how much need you have in the event of your death. You could then compare that against the other assets that you have and the insurance that you have and see if you're well enough covered.
Okay, so how does one go about starting the process of actually shopping for an affordable policy?
One of the great things about today is the internet provides tons of information, right? But I think that's a great place to start. I think you first do the calculation we talked about. So you get a base idea of how much coverage do you need and what's right for your situation in terms of the actual dollar amount. Then you kind of go online, I think, and get a basic education, basic understanding of the different types of life insurance that are out there. Broadly speaking, you've got two categories. There's term life insurance, and there's what are called permanent life insurance policies, the type that have a cash value that builds up in them. But I think if you do that first, if you know what you need, then you understand the types of insurance, then you actually go to somebody that you trust, whether it's a company you work with, an agent that you've worked with in the past. At least you go in with an informed understanding of, okay, how does this whole thing work? And then they can probably help you fill in the blanks and get you to the right type of policy.
And Scott, can an annual premium ever go up, or is it sort of fixed?
It depends. I guess by saying it depends, it means yes, it could go up, right? So it depends on the type of coverage, though. So a lot of times what you look at, I talked about the term insurance or the permanent insurance. So term insurance is an example. It comes in different flavors. You know, there is what's known as annual renewable term insurance. There is 10-year term, 20-year term, 30-year term. And the term that I'm referring to there, that tells you how long your premium payment is going to stay the same. So if it's a 20-year term policy, that means I get the policy today, I make my payments, and they're not going to change for the next 20 years. At the end of that 20 years, then the premium is no longer guaranteed to be the same. And in most cases, it's going to adjust up to what your age is at that point in time, which quite frankly makes it pretty expensive. The permanent life insurance policies, the cash value types, those will tend to have they try at least in many cases to have a level premium for the life of the policy. And they do that by collecting cash, extra cash from you up front. That gets deposited in the account that then helps offset some of those higher costs in the future.
So, Scott, does it ever make sense to purchase life insurance for children?
I think it does. I don't think anybody really wants to run out there and do that. It's not a terribly exciting thing for folks. But the reality is, you know, if you lose a child, if you go through that unfortunate experience, of course it's an emotionally devastating event. But the problem is, you know, funerals are not cheap. Nor could some of the medical expenses be if it was a medical issue that caused it. So I do think that it's important that people have coverage on their children. There's different approaches to it, though. Some people think, hey, you buy a policy for the child that you can then give them later on down the line when they get older. Other people take the approach of, I just want to make sure that there's some coverage in place. I'll add it as a rider onto my existing policy, or I'll get it through my employer. But the short answer to your question is yes. I do think it's important for people to have at least some level of life insurance on their children.
And Scott, very quickly, because this is a whole nother conversation, but long-term care insurance, how do we even know if we do decide that we should purchase it? How do we even know that the company will be in existence, say, 40 or 50 years from now when Barbara and I will need it?
That's the same question that's true with a life insurance company, you know? Because people, you know, hopefully you never need the coverage, right? But if you do, hopefully you don't need it for decades down the line. So it's important that when you purchase insurance, whatever type it is, you know, whether it's long-term care or life insurance, that you work with a company that's highly rated, that you believe from a financial stability perspective is going to be there for you when the time comes. And the rating agencies, you know, provide, you know, ratings of the different types of insurance companies, and and can give you a pretty good handle on it. But the point that I think that really that drives that home is you don't. It's not a case where cheaper is always better. And I know people, when I say that to them, they say, "Yeah, well, you're just trying to sell me more expensive insurance." Well, I'm not trying to sell you anything. But it's true that sometimes if you go for the cheapest type of insurance, you get what you pay for. And you might be getting not the best coverage, or you might be getting it from a company that might not be here when you need it.
Scott Hallowell, Certified Financial Planner, thanks so much for clearing up the fog for the two boomer babes on life insurance.
Thank you.
In the heart of Hollywood, Molly Bloom was once known as the poker princess. She had the uncanny ability to organize high-stakes poker games for millionaires and celebrities alike. In her late 20s, she built one of the most exclusive underground poker games in the world, amassing great wealth, and then she lost it all.
Molly Bloom joins us from Los Angeles. Her tell-all book is called Molly's Game, From Hollywood's Elite to Wall Street's Billionaire Boys Club, My High-Stakes Adventure in the World of Underground Poker. Welcome, Molly.
Thank you so much.
Molly, how on earth did you go from being a girl who was raised in Loveland, Colorado, and a shining member of the U.S. ski team to being a 27-year-old sought-after gambling organizer? How did that all start?
I think it's a question I'm still trying to understand, but after I quit the U.S. ski team and I was headed to law school, I wanted to take a year off and just kind of have a mini adventure. So I thought L.A. was a good place to do it. And ultimately, I ended up getting a waitressing job. And the guys who hired me also owned the Viper Room, which is a, kind of this iconic rock and roll venue in Los Angeles. And they said, as one of your jobs, we want you to be a cocktail waitress for our poker game and help run it.
So what exactly does it mean? What did you have to do?
I didn't even know. I went home and I Googled what kind of music do poker players like to listen to and tried to make a playlist with songs like The Gambler, and I brought a cheese plate, and I had no baseline for what this was going to be. And as I'm standing there, small town girl with my cheese plate, Ben Affleck starts, you know, walks in, Leonardo DiCaprio, heads of studios, politicians, all these incredibly larger-than-life people that I never thought that I would interface with. And then on top of that, they're handing me stacks of cash. At that time, the buy-in was $10,000. So I'm standing in the corner. I'm counting $100,000 in cash. And these guys are speaking very openly and freely. And a kind of light bulb went off in my head, which was, what an insane way to network and to meet people and to parlay this maybe into some other career. And then at the end of the night, I made $3,000, which was at that time and now again, it was a huge number for me.
Huge number.
Yeah. And so I checked it out with the attorneys and they said, as long as you're not doing anything else like supplying drugs or behaving like a casino, it seems like you found a nuance.
What games did you actually organize? I guess it wasn't fish.
No. It wasn't fish. It was Texas Hold'em poker.
Molly, did you even know how to play poker?
No.
And
by the way, I still really don't.
Really?
But what I did is I started seeing that this was a very coveted event to be part of. And this was still, I was just waitressing. I was just calling the guys. I was working under these other guys. But there's only 9 or 10 seats, and it's access to celebrity. It's access to billionaires. A lot of businesses getting done, and it became this very elite event. And in order to secure their seats, people started tipping me a lot of money. And eventually, after the first year, I said to myself, I want this. I want to run this myself. I don't want to work under these other guys. And ultimately, I made that happen. And so for the next 4 years, the stakes got higher. People were winning and losing millions of dollars. I was making a ton of money. I was doing silly things like buying a Bentley in cash and shopping in Rodeo and just kind of the things that you shallowly dream of when you're in your 20s or whatever.
So, Molly, did you pay taxes on all this money?
I did.
We don't work for the IRS, we promise.
Yeah. Don't worry. Every government agency knows all my personal business these days. It's fine. Yeah, I did. I incorporated a company, an event planning company, and I was running everything through that, and I was paying my taxes.
So you went from being a cocktail waitress with these games to organizing the games?
Yes, and then eventually I started bankrolling the games, meaning that when I would bring in new players, I would have to vet them to the best of my ability. And then if they didn't pay, I was responsible for making good on the debt. So I had a lot of girls working for me. We were recruiting players all the time. I was doing art deals. I was investing in people's hedge funds. It was just kind of like learning business in this very strange but awesome way. And I was also having the time of my life.
Can only imagine. So, Molly, who actually played in your games, the ones that you organized? I mean, some of these were like incredible movie stars, right?
The regular players were Tobey Maguire, Ben Affleck. Leonardo DiCaprio played from time to time. When I moved to New York in 2008, started doing games there, Alex Rodriguez played quite often. Matt Damon played once. Just some of the most famous faces of our time. And then also some of the richest guys in the world.
Now, we read in your book that Tobey Maguire would put Leonardo DiCaprio in the game just to be a magnet to actually attract other players.
Yes.
So who would Leonardo attract? I mean, he'd attract me if I had any money. I'd be there.
The thing is there's this celebrity obsession in Los Angeles. And then there's also a lot of people with a lot of money, billionaires, who want access to these people. So what Tobey was trying to accomplish was attracting what people in Vegas call whales, which are high net worth individuals with not a lot of skill level that just, they're either gambling addicts or they are just paying to be part of the lifestyle in a sense.
This is the Two Boomer Babes, and we're talking about the high-stakes game of underground poker with our guest, Molly Bloom. Molly is the author of Molly's Game.
So, Molly, I'm listening to this, and I'm thinking, oh, my God. You know, as a parent, I can't even imagine what your parents must have been thinking. So were you open with them? I mean, did they know what you were doing?
Well, I was giving them a very watered-down PG-13 version.
I bet you were.
I think that they started, especially my mom, because moms are real tapped in, you know.
We can sort through the rubble, trust me.
Yeah, my dad was just happy I was making money and probably not asking him for money on a monthly basis, but my mom knew to an extent what was going on. But in L.A., it was really pretty kind of a safe. There was nobody threatening my life. There was nobody trying to stiff the game. It was pretty safe, I would say. When I moved to New York, the scope of everything changed dramatically. You know, I was naive. I was used to having my games at the Four Seasons and the celebrities and the businessmen showing up and it being a pretty straightforward event. But in New York, the underground poker scene is oftentimes run by organized crime. There was already games that existed with some men that kind of represented the different sort of ethnic groups in New York, and they certainly were not welcome to the competition. So I ran into a lot of problems in New York.
So did the mafia or organized crime ever approach you to work for them?
They approached me, and they said that they wanted to be a partner in my game, and in exchange, they would offer protection, and they would collect debts from me.
Oh, my gosh.
And I said, I really appreciate the offer, but I'm going to have to politely decline. I mean, the last thing I was going to do is get involved in organized crime. And it was the kind of thing where it wasn't an offer. They were telling me that I didn't have a choice. So by declining that, then they sent somebody to intimidate and ultimately assault me at my apartment.
And it was more than just an assault. Can you describe what happened?
They put a gun in my mouth, and then they beat me up and forced me to open my safe and took the money that was in there and some of the jewelry that was in there. Some of it was inherited from my grandmother. And they called again, and right before I was going to have to be forced to meet with them again, this was 2010, and it was the biggest mafia takedown in New York City history. They arrested 127 people, and it was literally days before they were insisting that I meet with them again. And then I never heard from them again.
Wow.
It was scary. It was terrible. But it was also an indication that I was now placing this game, this money, this perceived power above absolutely everything in my life, including safety, because I didn't consider walking away from it.
Well, Molly, so eventually the FBI agents raided one of your games in New York and everything went south. Tell us what happened.
March 2011, the FBI raided one of my games. And then the next day, I looked on my bank account and all my assets were seized. And they wanted me to come in and talk to them about organized crime, and I didn't do that. So I moved back into Colorado with my mom, and I had no money, and I tried to put my life back together. And after 2 years, I had gotten a job, was writing this book, and I had gotten a book deal from HarperCollins, and I thought that I was past it. And I moved back to L.A., and 5 days later, 17 FBI agents, 5 Secret Service, came to my apartment, arrested me, put a piece of paper in front of me that said the United States of America versus Molly Bloom. And for the last year or so, I was looking at 5 to 10 years hanging over my head of jail time. I got sentenced May 2nd of this year, and the judge was awesome and merciful, and he gave me a year of probation.
So, Molly, what were you exactly charged with?
The charge is called running an illegal gambling business.
So when did you exactly cross the line? Because it wasn't illegal when you were back in California, but
right.
then you got moved to New York
right.
to kind of up the ante, and you yeah. crossed the line. What did you do?
So I was having so many different games that it was a lot less possible to vet these players and find out their financial standings and who they were. And I was getting stiffed a lot, meaning people were not, you know, they would come, they would play, I would extend credit, and then they wouldn't pay their debts. And I had to write big checks. So as sort of an insurance policy, I started taking a rake, which means you take a percentage of each pot. And then the total of that pot goes into kind of a reserve for situations in which you get stiffed. I checked it out with my attorneys. They told me if I went from getting tipped to taking a rake, that it was breaking the law, but it was a misdemeanor. My lawyer said to me, it's kind of like in the same category as trespassing. And I am certainly not excusing taking a rake, but I was absolutely not aware of the weight of the consequences. So that was when I crossed the line.
So Molly, what are you doing now? What's next for Molly Bloom?
I hope a movie is in
yes.
the works of this life.
You know what? That's what I really want to do. That's why I'm in L.A. right now, because I am entertaining offers from 3 of the kind of top producers in Hollywood to option the book into a movie. So fingers crossed. Hope that works out, because I would love to make a little money and then just be able to start a normal life.
Well, that's great. We wish you the best of luck, Molly.
Thanks so much.
Molly Bloom, author of Molly's Game, From Hollywood's Elite to Wall Street's Billionaire Boys Club, My High-Stakes Adventure in the World of Underground Poker. Thanks so much for sharing your amazing story with the two Boomer Babes.
Thank you so much.
Entering the dating world in midlife can be a bit overwhelming. Chances are you've been married before or in a relationship for years and haven't dated since you were in your 20s. It's all changed, including the rules.
Joining us to shoot the breeze about navigating the online options and to understand what boomer dudes are looking for relationship-wise is Ken Solon. He's the author of The Boomer Guide to Finding True Love Online.
Hey, Ken, so you suggest that when looking for a partner, your worlds have to collide to meet, and online dating offers the greatest opportunities for that to happen. And that's a direct quote. So why go online looking for love?
I can't imagine any other way for boomers to have so many available other single people to meet. And also the fact that it's impersonal in some ways makes it easier than going to a party or something where you're on the spot. And I think if you develop some dating skills, you can learn an awful lot about people from looking at their online profiles. And you also can learn what to ask once you start talking to them.
So what are some of these skills you talk about?
I think the most important aspect of finding a life partner is to find somebody who's as much like you as possible, who shares your best qualities, who shares your interests. I think the notion of opposites attracting has been debunked for many, many years now, and it just doesn't work. In my book, I mentioned finding your doppelganger, you know, your absolute twin. And I've done an awful lot of dating in my life, and I've heard from tens of thousands of readers from my Huffington Post articles, and pretty much everybody agrees that the key is to meet somebody as much like you as possible.
If I hadn't heard that this was the key, you know, I would have thought that was a very scary thought, Ken.
Well, it is scary. And the reason it's scary is that everybody thinks, well, okay, but that person's probably going to have all my worst qualities,
yeah.
too. Well, that isn't necessarily true. But even if it is true, at least you'll have the same sort of skills to work things out when problems always arise in relationships, and you'll be able to work them out together.
Well, Ken, you also write about the importance of pacing a relationship. What does that mean? Like, you don't ask the person to marry you on the second date?
Well, you know, I've actually heard from, especially from women who go out on a coffee date, and by the end of the coffee date, the fellow they're sitting across from says, I know this sounds crazy, but I feel like I'm falling in love with you already. It's like, ouch, no, don't say that.
I'd run.
Yeah, we know what that guy wants.
Don't say that. But pacing, even once you start dating, you know, somebody's going to probably fall in love before someone else. And I think it's important to respect each other's pacing. And just because you may feel like you're falling deeply in love doesn't mean that you should push the other person in your direction.
Well, you also suggest that we should actually be honest. So what's that all about?
Well, you know, I wrote an article last year for the Huffington Post about why men need to be emotionally honest with women. And it got over 2,000 comments overnight, which is huge even for them. And 1,000 women said, yes, of course, we've always said this. And 1,000 guys said, what are you, crazy? You can't be honest with women. So there's the split, what I call the undeclared boomer dating war. And I think emotional honesty is very important. And, of course, to some degree in the beginning, you don't want to pour your heart out to somebody you don't know. But you'll never create a successful relationship that doesn't include and embrace emotional honesty.
You know, as we get older, at least in my case, I find my filter getting more holes in it. so you don't want to share all, right?
No. Especially in the beginning, I think that could be terrifying. I met with Brené Brown once, who writes an awful lot about vulnerability. And I said, well, gee, you know, how much vulnerability can you show at first? And she said, well, probably very little. I think nothing's more frightening than meeting somebody for the first time and having them pour their heart out to you.
That is a little scary.
Yeah.
So, Ken, finally, what is your numero uno advice for finding true love? Oh, you sure have to think about it.
Well, I think number one is stop typecasting your dates. Stop dating the same person with different names over and over and over. Everyone I dated was short, blonde, ski jump nose. And the woman I ended up falling in love with 2 years ago is tall, she has kinky brown hair, and a large nose and looks nothing like any of those other women. But she also doesn't act like those other women. But we tend to pick people based on their photos. Oh, yeah, that's my type. Well, you may have been your type 20 years ago or 10 years ago. Maybe it's time to reexamine what your type is.
Well, Ken Solin, author of The Boomer Guide to Finding True Love Online. Great advice, but I hope Kathy and I don't need it anytime soon. Thanks so much for shooting the breeze with the babes.
Thanks for having me.
Bailey Chase offers a lifestyle of flexibility and choice that provides you new opportunities to experience your independence and enrich your life. For more information about the lifestyle Bailey Chase offers, visit integrace.org. Equal housing opportunity.
Support comes from Accent on Travel, Rehoboth Beach, with a Viking Rhine River cruise with us, the two Boomer Babes. For questions and reservations, 302-703-6154.
And now it's time for us babes to give credit where credit is due.
Audio and technical guru Julio Gonzalez, who magically pulls it all together.
Webmaster wizard Gail Jane, who makes TwoBoomerBabes.com a fab place to visit.
Founding members of the Chicago chapter of the Two Boomer Babes Supper Club, Mike and Larry Israel, for your unfailing love and support.
Our husbands, daughters, family, and friends, even with smirks and eye rolls, who encourage us all the way.
And give us great material, often without knowing it.
Our moms and upstairs directors, Jane and Sally, who are cheering us on from their bridge game in the sky.
Our home away from home, Delmarva Public Radio. And to you, our listeners, for joining us each week and spurring us on.
Two Boomer Babes is a production of Two Boomer Babes Media in collaboration with Zimer Communications.